in the press, there was a lot being said about community. I don't know if you, our community together and the community who we are in the spirit. So I thought that that was a little coincidence in which God was wanting to remain anonymous. But being as I don't like him remaining anonymous, I thought I'd tell you. So here we go. Just you can open your Bibles, although I won't read for a couple of minutes, to 2 Chronicles 10. 2 Chronicles 10. You can open there. And I've said before that the word for temple is the word house, beit. But of course, a house in the ancient world, was an extended family. It was a community. It wasn't a nuclear family of two or three, but it would have usually been somewhat of what we would call a community. And the temple is the community of the Lord. That's why our Lord's first words when he was 12 years old was that he had to be in his father's house, the temple. The last teaching of Jesus in the upper room is he speaks about my father's house. Okay, not the house in Jerusalem, but the house in heaven. And the temple, we've not mentioned a lot about this, but the temple is a paradigm of a community of love, drawn together by the mercy of God. And I've got another rather nice word for you. This is one of my favorite words. And this is a Rwandan word. Got a pen, I think, that works in. Get it spelt right. Imbabazi. Imbabazi. And in Rwandan, imbabazi is the word for mercy. It's rather a nice word, isn't it? Imbabazi, imbabazi. And how they define that in Rwanda, is this. Mercy is a place where you would receive all the love and care a mother would give you. Isn't that beautiful? Mercy is a place where you'd receive all the love and care a mother would give you. And that is the temple. That's the Father's house. That's where we go to receive mercy and grace to help in our time of need. Now, a couple of other things as we just ease our way. John McMurray, Scottish philosopher and theologian, made a distinction between a society and a community. He said, a society is a collection of individuals indirectly related to one another by law, employment, contract, economics, geography, etc., etc. Whereas, well, who could say, what's the difference between a society and a community? What's the difference between a society and a community?
Personal relationship.
Yeah, okay. Kim, you want to go? Yes, because a community, as defined by John McMurray, a community is a group of persons directly related by love. Okay, so if it's a covenant community, it is it's not contractual, but it's based on love. And so we are not a society. We live in a society, but we are a community. And I always remember when I lived in the Middle East. I can remember where I was standing. This was so many years ago. And a brother came up to me. He was Cypriot. And he said, you know, Ray, there's a difference between clan and community. Because in Cyprus, almost if you ask anybody, you know, what's your name? And, and they say, so-and-so. If two Cypriots are talking, they'll know other people, you know, 75 miles away with that same name, because they're all interrelated. And why isn't clan community? if community is a group of persons directly related by love, what is a clan? It's a community of persons directly related by
blood.
That's right. And that can be a very different thing indeed. A very different thing indeed. And so we're not clan. Clan is usually very introverted, okay, very exclusive. A community is a community of love. It's facing outward. It's not contractual. It's not a society. And that is the paradigm of the temple. That is, and why we're a community of love is because we're a porous community. And so if you were listening to Pastor Tai this morning, you see, we're a community of love. We're not a clan locked in, and we're not a society contractual, but we're a porous community, meaning that people, by the osmosis that's kind of part of love, they can get in the midst of us. And that's what Tai was speaking about this morning, and that's what the temple is. Be back to you just in a minute. Let me just say one other thing. This is another great Scottish theologian, MacLeod Campbell, and this is very, very important when we think about the temple. He speaks about what he calls the retrospective and the prospective aspects of the work of Christ. Now, retrospective is all the froms, okay? It's retro, from guilt, from sin, from hell, from death, etc., etc. And sometimes we look a lot at that and we forget that the temple, the atonement, the work of Christ, is not only from, but it's to sonship, it's to adoption, it's to community, it's to communion, it's to justice, and so on and so forth. Now, where we're going with the temple is it is not just retrospective, okay, delivering us from guilt, from sin, from hell, from death, okay? It is a prospective paradigm, okay? So it's taking us somewhere. Here we come to community. It's a sign of the kingdom, a community of justice, joy, and peace. Somebody said it's the earthly historical form of Jesus. Isn't that lovely? The earthly historical, that's who we are this morning, as the temple of the Holy Spirit, okay? We're the earthly historical form of Jesus. We're supposed to be a contrast society, okay? Tragically, we're often not. We're seduced by the surrounding society, but we're supposed to be a contrast society. And we are called to be now what the world is called to be ultimately. And this is all what the temple is pointing towards. So let me just say perhaps a couple of other things, and then we'll be reading from the text. Again, back to John McMurray. He said there were three ways of looking at the world. Three ways of looking at the world. And the first he calls, and this is very, very important, the first he calls ascetic, an ascetic apperception or contemplative. And this is wonderful, and this is in the Bible. And an apperception is kind of your the aperture through which you look at life. Okay, and this was the Greeks. This was primarily the Greeks. And the way, the lens through which they viewed life was truth, goodness, and beauty. And that's great. That's wonderful. Okay? Really, really good. And lots of the Bible in there. But what happens when you get in Auschwitz or Belsen and there is no truth or beauty or goodness anywhere? You need something else. And so the second apperception is the Roman apperception, and this is probably dominant in the West today. And it's a pragmatic apperception. And the Romans were the great how-to people. how to construct phenomenal buildings, how to get the Pax Romana, how to extend the peace through law and government. And very much that's dominant in a technical kind of information-driven society. And we have that pragmatic apperception. And that's good as well. We need some how-tos. Thank God for them. We wouldn't be here today if it... But there's a deeper one. And this is the Hebrew apperception, which is all relational. It's all based in relationship. And we value truth and goodness and beauty, and we value the how-tos because we want to make a difference for the kingdom. But fundamentally, you see, we're born out of the Trinity, which is relational, giving yourself away, the Father to the Son, and the Son to the Father, in the love of the Holy Spirit. That is what we're born out of. That's what creation is birthed out of, and that's where we live. That is what the temple is modeling. And when we come to our three circles that we're drawing very frequently, one being family, the other being church, and the other being state, of course, these are all relational circles. Relational circles. Now, just one other thing, then we will read the text. There's a wonderful Latin phrase. You might not know Latin, it doesn't really matter, but it's worth copying down. Inter hominem esse. And it's the Latin for being alive, which translated literally means to be among men, or to be, you're not really alive. You're not really alive unless you are in relationship. And again, I was reading an article on Rwanda. That's why you have the Rwanda Imbabazi, okay, mercy. In Rwanda, they say a person is a person through persons. Isn't that beautiful? A person is a person through persons. And that's why John Wesley used to say, solitary saints are as unbiblical as holy adulterers. In other words, you can't be an adulterer and be holy. It's an oxymoron. And you can't be a saint and be solitary, because we're in community. And the temple, as we'll see again in a moment, the temple is all human relationships, family, the people of God, whether it was Israel or the church, and the state. This is the temple. And I will say it once more, please don't say that the church or the people of God is the temple. No, it embraces all of human relationships, embraces the state, governance, embraces the family, all of them. And this is the community that is continued in the church. Now, where we're going, you might wonder, where is this going? It really is going somewhere, okay? The temple was to be the focus of the community, the umbrella of the community. And in the New Testament, the temple is the community. We are the temple. And the community is constituted and guarded by these spheres of family, church, and state. And the epicenter is the Lord's throne, the ark, okay? And within the ark is the law, which guards and guides the community. And Chronicles concludes by 19 case studies of how the kings guarded or undermined this community Jesus called the Father's house. So that's where we're going. And we are going to now go fast, okay? This, you don't believe me, but it's really true, okay? It's really true. Here's Second Chronicles, and this is where we've been. We've been with Solomon and the temple. Chapters 1 to 10, okay? Began with the death of David, come to Solomon and the temple. And now the kingdom is going to divide. And we're going to have Israel in the north. They're going to last for 209 years. We're going to have Judah in the south. They're going to last for 345 years until the fall of Jerusalem, which is the end of Second Chronicles. So this is where we're going now, okay? We're now going to look at the division of the kingdom after Solomon dies. There'll be the fall of Samaria, and then Judah will be alone. And let me just say this. These are the sons of David that we are going to be looking at very, very rapidly. You discount this. Where is she? I've lost her. I've got to stand. Yes. You discount Athaliah. She was not from the house of David, and she was not a legitimate queen, but she needs to be on the list, and I'll explain why. Now, when you see that list up there, I'm sure you don't look at it and say, I just cannot wait to learn about Ahaziah. I've all my life been longing to learn about Ahaziah. I can't wait. This is going to be the most exciting thing in the world. No, you look at that list and you think, what a bore, you know, what a grind, you know, these kings in the north and kings in the south and all these strange names and, you know. But hey, these are the guardians of a movement that God has raised up to heal the wound of the world. That's what it's all about. That there would be no, what we were hearing Ty speak about this morning, God raised up the sons of David to bring this to an end, to birth the Messiah who would birth a community, which is the church, a community of redemption and justice, okay, to bring salvation and justice to the ends of the earth. And for 345 years, these are the people that steward that recovery movement. There is nothing else more important. Now, in there, okay, you're going to find lots of other global leaders. They'll only get a minor mention because this is God's big move, okay, to bring this about. And that's why in talking about the temple, I've widened it from, okay, just the sphere of the church, because as I've said many times, okay, if the activity of God stops at the boundary of the church, we are in trouble. It's got to penetrate every part of society. And these people now are the stewards of that movement that's going to bring justice and salvation and the end of rape and murder and drive-by shootings and street children. Bring it to an end. That's why God has raised it up. Now, unfortunately, remember the retrospective and the prospective. You see, often when we look at the temple or we look at the cross, it's retrospective. What have I been delivered from? From guilt, from shame, from sin, from... That's only the beginning. The prospective is that, hey, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. Okay? Justice will be, as Isaiah says, like a river, like a mighty stream. And that is why we have the temple, and these are the guardians of this movement of God. Now, unfortunately, they're not a very faithful band of brothers, as we will see in a moment. So let's now go to chapter 10, and we'll begin at the beginning with Solomon's son, whose name is Rehoboam. And he starts off these 19 people that end with Zedekiah. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to handle this material differently. And we've kind of been going chapter by chapter. Now we're just going to be dipping in here, dipping in there. We're going to be going consecutively, but you should have notes, okay? You should have notes, and this is case studies in kingship, Rehoboam, and it should look something like this. Okay, if you can find that, then you can go fast with me. And I'll be referring not to every point, okay? We don't have time for that. You've got the points, you've got the notes, and I'm just going to kind of parachute down from time to time and pick up a point, and then if you want to take it further, you've got the notes and you've got the text, and we can move quickly. Otherwise, we will not get through these 19 people. So we're going to go rapidly. So chapter 10, 2 Chronicles, verse 1. Then Rehoboam, Solomon has just died now, Rehoboam his son went to Shechem in about the middle of the nation, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And it came about when Jeroboam, okay, we got Rehoboam, now Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was in Egypt, where he had fled from the presence of King Solomon, that Jeroboam returned from Egypt. Now, what had happened, okay, you need a little bit of history here. Jeroboam was an important official in the government of Solomon, okay, in the north, important official. And he's in Jerusalem, I suppose, reporting on what he's up to for Solomon, and a prophet meets him. Abijah, the prophet, meets him, and he's wearing a new robe. He takes off his robe, and he rips it into 12 pieces, and he gives Jeroboam 10 pieces of the robe, and he says, because of Solomon's idolatry and faithfulness, I'm removing 10 pieces of Israel and giving them to you, and I will give you an abiding house, he says. Now, Solomon hears about this. Rehoboam flees for his life to Egypt, where he stays until Solomon dies. But obviously he is a leader, and so what happens, verse 3, so they sent and summoned Jeroboam, and when Jeroboam and all Israel came, they spoke to Solomon's son. Rehoboam said, your father made our yoke hard. Now therefore lighten the harsh labor. That is an Exodus word. You'll find it in Exodus 5 and in Exodus 6. It's what Pharaoh did to them. Lighten the harsh labor of your father and the heavy yoke. Another Exodus, Egypt word in Exodus 6, which he put on us, and we will serve you. So he said to them, return to me again in 3 days. So the people departed. And what he does is he goes to the elders, and he says, what should I do? And the elders say, well, just, you know, Solomon, he really pushed the envelope, so just be kind to them, and they'll be faithful, they'll serve you. And he forsakes the counsel of the elders. He goes to the young men, who are also from the house of David. We'll see that in a minute. Goes to the young men, and they say, no, Solomon taxed them hard. You push it even further. That's what you need to do. And so down to verse 12. So Jeroboam and the people came to Rehoboam on the third day. Now this is tragedy. This is tragedy. This is the division of the people of God. And of course, Solomon has a divided heart, and a divided heart is going to lead to a divided kingdom. And 10 tribes are going to disappear because of this. Verse 13, and the king answered them harshly, and King Rehoboam forsook the counsel of the elders, and he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to it. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from God. Now that little word turn there, you need to mark it. We'll come back to this. In the Hebrew, it simply says, for it was a turn from God. It was a turn from God, that the Lord might establish his word, which he spoke through Ahijah, you remember, when he met Jeroboam, ripped up his cloak. the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Then verse 16. And when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, "What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to your tent, O Israel. Now look after your own house, David." So all Israel departed to their tents. They disinherited themselves from the house of David. And verse 19, so Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Now, what we're going to do with these 19 kings is we are going to evaluate them. Just going to draw these a little bit larger, because this is what the chronicler does. We're going to evaluate them on how they interact with the temple paradigm. And the first thing that's going wrong is the family of David. There's only one family now. The family of David is becoming totalitarian, okay? And this family circle, which is now the family of David, okay, put in a V there, okay, is now pressing its authority beyond the boundaries. And as we've seen, its boundaries are the all-important thing. That's what's happening here, and it's a disaster. So just look at a couple of things on your sheet there. He forsook the council of the elders, and council is used six times here, okay? Because council is needed if the theocracy is going to operate properly through the monarchy. The theocracy has not gone away. It's now just operating through the monarchy. And the young men who grew up with him were not elders. They were also from the house of David, which we'll see. And so he now forsakes these boundaries, okay, by excessive taxation, which was a violation of the law. And then it ends up that he forsook the law of the Lord, and they walked in the way of David and Solomon for just 3 years. Unbelievable. And then the prophet says, because Shishak comes up from Egypt, and the prophet says, it's astonishing, he said, because you'll find in the text that when Shishak appears on the scene, they humble themselves. And the prophet says, if you had not humbled yourself, this is astonishing. Now, this is king number one, if I can find my little list. The prophet says, if you had not humbled yourself, God would have destroyed everything, all wiped out off the map, okay? Now, this is interesting because they've just got the temple up, okay? Solomon has just gone into action, and now God says, if you'd not humbled yourself, okay, Pharaoh, Shishak, I would have allowed him to knock everything down, wipe it all out. Now, why? Why? Yeah, exactly. I mean, let's say an architect builds a model. Let's say Michael builds a model of a new something or other. Okay, new state capital or whatever. Okay, and there's this beautiful architect's model, and I go into his office one night and I say, "Well, I really don't like that wing over there. I'm going to move it here, and I don't like that tower there. I think I'm going to move it over here." And whatever. Well, when Michael comes in the morning, it's useless. It's useless because it's not modeling what it's supposed to model. And so he will probably throw it away and build another one. And you see, if we fail in our stewardship, you see, to be this contrast society, this community of love, not a clan, okay, not bound together by contractual arrangements, if we fail to be what the temple is, then God will simply, okay, remove the candlestick. Okay, because what's the use, you see? So God said, if you'd not humbled yourself, Shishak would have wiped the slate clean. God could have still fulfilled his purposes of bringing a Messiah, but not through that route. And so that becomes hugely important for us. Because you see, unless we model, okay, this not just, okay, not just what is retrospective, but what is prospective, what we've been called to be and to model and to do and to bring to the ends of the earth, then there's really not much point. We're not here to sing hymns. You get the point. This is very important. So just a couple of things on Rehoboam, and then we'll move on. If you move to the second page, I really just want to mention one thing on page 2. We could mention a lot of things on page 2. The consequences are huge and are still with us today. The consequences. The house is divided against itself, which means eventually 10 tribes will disappear entirely. Idolatry is established in the north and will last for the whole of their history. The whole of their history, where they will be intertwined with idolatry. Because you remember, when they divide the kingdom, okay, here's the division, the north-south division. You remember Jeroboam, he puts a golden calf at Bethel, and he puts another one at Dan. Why does he do that? Do you remember? Why does he do that? Okay, so right in the north and right in the south. But why? Why? Yeah, he is afraid, you see, that they will come down to Jerusalem to the feasts. And God had said, hey, I'll give you a firm dynasty if you'll trust in me. But he did not. He did not. He lost it. And so now we've got idolatry established in the north, and we've got the first... I hope that didn't... That was an ouch, wasn't it? I hope that was not on anybody. And now we've got the first invasion of the south by Shishak, the king of Egypt. Now, just one little interesting thing here. Okay? The first invasion is because they are... Unfaithful. Turn to chapter 12 with me. Chapter 12. It's very, very important. Chapter 12. And this is where we're just moving ahead a little faster than normal. It took place, chapter 12, verse 1, when the kingdom of Rehoboam was established and strong, and that he and all Israel with him forsook the law of the Lord. And it came about in King Rehoboam's fifth year, because they had been unfaithful to the Lord, that Shishak, king of Egypt, came against Jerusalem, etc. Verse 5, then Shemaiah the prophet came to Rehoboam and the princes of Judah who had gathered at Jerusalem because of Shishak, and he said to them, thus says the Lord, you have forsaken me, you've been unfaithful, you've forsaken me, so I also have forsaken you, to Shishak. And so the first invasion is because they are unfaithful, and the last invasion will also be because they're unfaithful. And what begins to happen now, I can find my little list of men, okay, and we'll come back to this in a moment, is that there is unfaithfulness here, and there is unfaithfulness, same word is used in chapter 36 here, and pretty much all the way through. And forsake is a key word in Chronicles. You have forsaken me, and so I have forsaken you, and the result is disaster. Just want to say one other thing, and then we'll have a couple of questions. On to your third page on Rehoboam. Then we'll have some questions. And this is kind of scary in a way, because when the prophet had come to Jeroboam, his king in the north, Okay, you have to keep your king straight. Okay, come to him and ripped up his cloak and given him 10 pieces. He said, the Lord will give you a lasting dynasty, a lasting dynasty. Do you know how long his dynasty lasted for? 2 years after he died. 2 years after he died. That was it. 2 years after he died, it was gone. It was gone. And promises are contingent. Covenants aren't, but promises are. And this man simply was not faithful to the Lord. And so he lost it. He lost it. Now, the other thing that we want to know is immediately, idolatry in both north and south leads to immorality. This is important. And even in, now this is the first king after Solomon, even in Rehoboam's day, there are male cult prostitutes. Okay, even this is the son of Solomon. And forsaking, of course, the first and second commandment leads to every other evil. And just by way of illustration, and we'll get a little more into this as we go on, there's Catholic social theory, which is good. Catholic social theory goes something like this. In a diverse society, we can use the second tablet of the law as the foundation of the social order. Because in a diverse society, we're not going to get agreements on religion, ethics, transcendentals, metaphysics, etc. But we probably can get agreement here. And so what they say is that we'll build the social order on the second tablet of the law, honor your father and mother, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness, don't covet. And I think I mentioned to you before that the the Institute for Global Ethics, which is a major high-powered think tank in California, they work globally, and they have identified, that they say every society they have examined, okay, agrees. In other words, they have not found a society anywhere in the world that doesn't say yes to all this. Yes, that it's good. In other words, nobody takes their child to school and goes up to the teacher and says, teacher, would you please teach my child to lie? I really want him to lie really well. Would you teach him to lie? Nobody does that. Nobody does that. Because, of course, there's something written in the heart, okay, that says these things are rights. Now, and so what Catholic social theory does, said, well, we'll build at least here. We'll build at least here because we can get some agreements here. Now, that's good. That's good. But what's its weakness? What's its weakness? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This is the problem. There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't have any longevity in it. And if you were here last week, you remember we did the triangle, and we said that what everybody wants is freedom. Okay, that's what everybody wants. That's what people in society, they may not have it, but that is their aspirations. There's something in us, we want to be free. We want to be free. Now, what the founders said, and they were building on a lot of biblical thought, is that to have freedom, you've got to have virtue. You've got to have virtue. In other words, to have freedom, people have got to be good. They've got to be ethical. They've got to be moral. They've got to tell the truth. They can't rig the ballot boxes, etc., etc. You can't have freedom unless there's virtue. It's impossible. And why wasn't there freedom in Iraq? Because there was a man at the top who was not virtuous. So whether it's angered into one man or the general kind of moral freefall in society, you won't have freedom unless there's virtue. But you won't have virtue, okay? Virtue is not a gas, okay, that floats around. It's not virtue. To have virtue, the founders said you needed... I know we don't like this word. You needed religion, okay, or pure religion. Yeah, there we go, pure religion. That's a good pure religion and undefiled before God, James. Okay, so to have a stable, you see, you've got to have some skyhooks, some transcendental anchors, because this is all very well and good, but when you have somebody like Adolf Hitler come along, he says, well, actually, I think we'd be much better off if we'd murder the Jews. That would really, you know, that would really be good, you know, for us. Or somebody else says, well, you know, I would really, you know, be much happier if I just made off with my secretary, and so whatever. Or somebody else says, hey, you know, April the 15th is a bad day for me, and so I'm just going to do a little tampering with my tax forms and whatever. And so, you see, virtue cannot stand alone. It's got to be anchored in other words, in some sanctions, in some transcendentals, in some accountability. And I was giving the illustration last week. The reason I don't early in the morning on Pacific travel at 60 miles an hour is not because I'm so virtuous, okay? It's because there is, you know, some... what do you call them? I always mix up state and what do you call them? Yeah, but what are the local police called? Because we don't have local and state troopers. But you don't have state troopers in Omaha, do you? Okay, I'm confused. Anyway, I know that they have that light on the top. That's what scares me. Just that little light going round, and so whatever. And you see, the reason I'm not up to 60 on Pacific early in the morning is not because Ray Mayhew is so virtuous. Nobody's looking, okay? And I have no Jesus loves you bumper stickers on my van, okay? None of that on my van. I feel I might let the Lord down, okay? But hey, why do I keep it down? Why do I keep it down to 35 or 40 perhaps, okay, is because there are some sanctions around. There's some accountability. And the framers said, okay, we want freedom. Have freedom, we need virtue. Okay, but virtue is not a gas. It's got to be anchored in transcendentals, okay? There is a God out there. And religion, what does religion need? Religion, to flourish, needs freedom. Okay, that's why they came in the Mayflower in the first place. But freedom needs virtue. Virtue needs religion. Religion to flourish needs freedom. And all those things need to be happening. And so the weakness here is, you see, we've got to have this. Now, how we get this in a pluralist society is another question. Okay, but these will go by the board eventually, unless we have some anchors over into this area here. Now, I think that's it on Rehoboam, although there might have been something else I was going to say on him, but I've talked for a long time, so let's have some questions. Yeah. Yes, I'm going to come to that in a moment. Okay, this important word, turn. Okay, thank you. Yes, Laura.
I'm just curious about the word religion needing freedom.
Yes.
Because of China, what's happening there and the thriving.
Yes. All religion as in China and what's happening in China is wonderful. Religion can survive, a la the early church. 300 years it was illegal to be a Christian. We can survive by the grace of God, but to flourish, do you see what I mean? We have to have freedom, which is why the Puritans came in the Mayflower, not because they couldn't, you know, survive in their walk with God. Do you see what I mean? But again, the temple is not my walk with God. It is getting this justice, this community, this salvation, this social transformation into the earth. And for that, we need freedom. So not for my, do you see what I mean, for my personal, because I can be locked in a prison, do you see what I mean, and still walk with the Lord. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Yes, Eugene.
Clarify when it says religion that they basically meant Christianity or biblical
yes.
Religion.
Yes, yes, that's
because
right.
I think I heard Dr. Kennedy say that the pilgrims that came were 98% Protestant, 1.8% Catholic, and I think it was 0.2% Jews.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when they meant religion, they meant the Bible
yes,
kind
indeed,
of religion,
indeed,
Christianity,
indeed,
not Hinduism or some other religion, right?
Because what I was saying last week, you remember, is that every system is cyclical. The great wheel of birth, maturation, growth, reproduction, and death. History is going nowhere. And as I said last week, there is only one religion that's embedded in real history, that's not myth, okay? And you go, you read the Upanishads and whatever, and it's all mythical, you know, good and evil taking place. The same if you read the Iliad, all the Greek gods, it's all mythical taking place. There is only one stream that is embedded in a historical process, and that is the Judeo-Christian stream. Only one. Islam is simply a Judeo-Christian heresy. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but Muhammad simply took material from both testaments, interspersed it with some poetry, etc., etc. And so that does have, at least to some extent, it's in a historical process. And so when we're talking, Eugene's question about religion is not any religion, because you're not going to find, you see, you're not going to find in this great wheel, you're not going to find any system of civic governance, because it's not going anywhere. But here, and this is what we did last week, of course, virtue is inculcated in the family. That's where virtue is taught. Religion, of course, in the church or the synagogue, and freedom is guarded by the state. So again, we have our three circles, and this is all embraced in the temple paradigm, and the kings we're looking at now are evaluated on how they honored or dishonored that paradigm, which is to guard human life. And again, I know I've said it, but sometimes children under the age of 5 will die of preventable diseases. Okay? It would take, to stop that, would take $2.5 billion a year, the approximate amount we spent on chewing gum. Okay? Okay, so these things do not to be, and why God started all this is to end all that. Okay? It's not just retrospective what I've been delivered from guilt, from shame, from bondage, from death, thank God. But it's where God wants to take human history into justice, into love, into community, into communion, into adoption, into goodness. Okay, that's the temple. I think I saw another hand. Yeah, Rich.
Any kind of, or if we can see that pattern, I know you allude to, you know, what we're doing here in this nation and, you know, seeing the deterioration of morals, and we see it's because, or we see it anyway, as a result of us abandoning God's way for our own. But I'm just curious, has anybody looked at that relative to the rise and fall of nations? And, I mean, can we draw that, those same conclusions as we can from the scripture?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned a number of times Irwin's study on sex and culture. Irwin was not a Christian. He wrote this study back in, I think, the 50s, but it's the kind of seminal study because he looked at so many societies around the world and plotted their kind of longevity and their resilience against their sexual restraint or their sexual promiscuity. That was his kind of grid. And he said that you lose, once you've lost sexual restraints, okay, and in other words, good order, you know, within family, etc., etc., you're not giving way to sexual perversion or whatever. Once you do, you've got a generation. You've got a generation. That's what he said. In other words, he said it's like, he used the analogy of the empty perfume bottle. Okay, you can get an empty perfume bottle, you can still smell the perfume for a while, okay? And he said that we can kind of live on the residual effect, you see, and certainly in Britain, when I was growing up, we were living on the perfume from the empty bottle. We had abandoned biblical religion, but still in England, when I was a kid, basically you still told the truth, and basically people were still decent neighbors and whatever. But now, a generation later, we've lost all that. We've lost all that. And so, yeah, this has been plotted, you know, demographically, you know, sociologically, etc. Okay. Yes, we've got Dan there.
I think in our history, God saved our country using Abraham Lincoln. We were in an institutional evil called slavery. And if you look at the way history was going, the North and South were divided. The economies were divided over slavery. The South was agrarian. The North was industrial in the way that our whole country is now. And Abraham Lincoln, quoting Jesus' words in Matthew 12:25, said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And God raised up Abraham Lincoln to save our country. And his mother taught him to read by reading the Bible. The reason he could go to law school was he was literate. And the way he learned to read in his mother's lap was reading God's word. And I really believe God delivered our country with that one man. Now, I don't know what he's going to do now. I'm praying about it. But I'm praying for another deliverer to come, because there was no single deliverer for the people of Israel.
Right.
And look what happened to them. They came under judgment, and it happened after their kingdom divided, after they were no longer a community, and they split down the middle, or they split in a bunch of different directions. And their enemies finished them off.
Let me just build on that. I know Glenn had his hand up, but I just want to build on that. What we'll see now is that here are our 19 kings, going to have our 19 kings, and God is going to be exceedingly patient, because what's happening under Jeroboam, and I'll show you this in a moment, is just foreshadowing what will happen under Zedekiah, and pretty much Zedekiah is the last king, and pretty much everything in between. So you don't have this, but you don't need it. Here's this span now of 345 years. These are the guardians of God's recovery movement to bring in Messiah and righteousness and justice to the ends of the earth. Okay, this is the first king, Rehoboam. This is the last king, Zedekiah. Look at the parallels. An invasion by Egypt, an invasion by Babylon. The treasure is removed from the temple. The treasure is removed from the temple. Why? Because they've devalued the temple spiritually, and so the pagans are going to plunder it physically. They're unfaithful. Now, question. Jesus said there was one legitimate reason for divorce. What was it? So there's one reason for legitimate divorce, which was what? Unfaithfulness. And again in Chronicles, this word unfaithful will come, because of course the Lord now is married, he's in covenant with Israel. And what he's saying is, I now have the right to divorce you. He won't break covenant, but he has the right to break covenant. And that's why they will go into exile, because of their unfaithfulness, and it will come again and again. The word forsaken is used with Rehoboam. The actual word is not used in 36, but the description is there. And then what's really interesting is I mentioned that Rehoboam, he is blamed for harsh labor, which is what Pharaoh was doing to them in Egypt. And Zedekiah, last king, it says he hardened his heart. Who did that? Who did that? Pharaoh. And so now these have become pharaohs. They're not the leaders of God's movement. They become, and so the temple is violated, the temple is destroyed. And so we had one or two Abraham Lincolns, like Josiah's, rising up, but it was almost too late to turn the tide at that point. And so what we're going to do here, and this is really, really important, you see, this is my, I know you've seen this before, but what we've got is 1,000 years. Got 1,000 years from David and Solomon, who were over an empire. We're now halfway. Well, a little. There's a governor when they first came back. They're a province of Persia. And this is the descent of the house of David from emperor to governor, not of an independent state, of a province of Persia. And then we're going to go to, from the house of David will be an unknown carpenter from Nazareth. This is the house of David. This is 1,000 years of decline. And we're kind of in the middle just at the moment. You think, how far can you go down? Well, you can go down even further, from carpenter to criminal. But then God, there's the turn coming, Gene. We'll see the God turned things. We'll see that. In fact, why don't we look at that? If you just go back, this is very important in Chronicles. Go back to chapter 10, where we were. Back to chapter 10. And we'll find in the book of Chronicles, there are two great turning points. Two great turning points. And if we follow it through, there are three. And I said in chapter 10 and in verse 15 that there's a rare Hebrew word here used. So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn from God, a turn of events from God. And what we have here is we've got this kind of moral freefall happening with Saul, just going down and down and down. And so God brings about the first turn of events. There's a 90-degree turn. And we get some stabilization with David and at least with the early Solomon. But then Solomon loses it. And so here, this was 1 Chronicles 10:14. Now we're reading 2 Chronicles 10, and it was again a turn from God. A turn from God. And now they've really got to go downhill. Really got to go downhill. Nearly a thousand years of decline. And then somebody is going to come wearing a leather jacket and eating locusts. And his name was John the Baptist, first biker. He didn't have a bike, but he had the jacket. Okay. And he is going to come and he is going to say what? What's his first word? Okay, repent, which in Hebrew is the word shub, to turn, to turn. So he's saying there is coming another turn. God is going to turn things around again. And the third, and of course, when the angel Gabriel appears to Mary, so John comes saying they've got a turn. When the angel Gabriel comes to Mary, he uses all the words of the Davidic covenant. He will be called the Son of the Most High. That was the name for the Davidic kings. And the Lord will give him the throne. That's what they had lost. There were no Davidic kings after about this point of his father David. So first turn to stop the decline. Okay, they're losing it again. Second turn, God is going to let this free fall happen, right down from emperor to governor, to carpenter, to criminal, but then God has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. Okay, other questions? Yes, Bob.
At least I think I understand, Ray, that with this temple paradigm, what God's trying to accomplish is really his, what he'd like to see is his kingdom arrive on earth,
yes,
rather than just waiting to get to heaven.
Yes.
And I think certainly, especially when Jesus came, he certainly highlighted the role of the individual and the importance of the individual in oppressive societies and how important that was.
Yes.
And sort of reminded me of about 35 years ago, my boss came in one day and said, you know, I know where Jesus is, because he was on the board, Archdiocese Board of Education. He pulled out his wallet and said, this is where Jesus is. And at the time, I thought that was pretty sacrilegious, but as I've grown and developed, I've found that it's just because we're living in that kingdom that's not the upside-down kingdom, where it's sort of like in Babylon, where the list in Revelation, it lists what's important. It lists, yes, gold and silver, and it goes down through jewels and fine woods, and finally you get to the very last. It's the bodies and souls of men, yes, that are important.
Yes.
And God's plan is really that we live in that upside-down kingdom where the bodies and souls of men are most important,
right,
then everything else drops off.
Right.
And I think in the United States, we've been replacing God with the God of materialism,
right,
and money. So the bodies and souls of men aren't the most important, as nearly as important today as it was back in the founding fathers, where they were willing to sacrifice all their fortunes and family for what was right. Now we see things where Clinton was reelected to the second term because of the economy was good. Money was more important to us than virtue. And so I think part of that's what we've got to really, again, have a single face, put our face on God and not be dual-faced, sort of like Solomon. And we can talk a good talk about being religious, but materialism is so important to us as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's right. And why this is important, and this is, I'll get to you, Glenn, next. And what we'll learn from these kings that don't seem very inspiring, we're going to learn all kinds of stuff about how one lives in society. And you're going to find with, I think it's the next king, that an army of 1 million come against him, an army of 1 million, massive, massive. And they repent, they seek the Lord, and they are secure. We're going to learn all kinds of principles about homeland security, but homeland security is tied in to keeping the law of God. That's the basis. This is all about that. It's all about that. If you keep the law of God, you'll be secure. You'll be secure. And what Bob is saying is that it obviously affects things like sexual morality and so on and so forth. But it also, again and again, it is the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. And the legislation in the law that will protect the poor, protect the weak, protect the marginal, protect the sojourner, etc., etc. And that is the law of the Lord. And again, Glenn reminded us a couple of weeks ago that Sodom was condemned for two things, and Glenn read them from Ezekiel. They were condemned for sexual perversion and for not caring for the poor, not caring for the poor. And so we're going to learn all kinds of principles tucked in here about homeland security. And we're going to learn all the kinds of principles about how we operate as a community. And unless, you see, unless we guard this, obviously it sources here, we guard this. If we lose this, no good sending soldiers overseas, okay? There is some, and that's where, you see, these 19 men, where are they? They keep disappearing because I think that they don't want their names to be seen, okay? I think if I was one of them, I wouldn't either. Most of them, with one or two exceptions, It's disaster. It's disaster. But Paul says these things are written for who? Who are these things written for? Corinthians. These things are written for us, upon whom the end of the ages have come. And so when we see the failure of a Solomon in his old age, or his son Rehoboam, is not to say, you know, they were really bad guys. It's to say, no, you know, these things are written for us. If we violate God's law, we will suffer the same consequences, whether that's sexual perversion or whether it is, as it says in Proverbs, closing one's eyes to the poor. Glenn has been patient with his hand up over there, and so we'll get to Glenn.
You had answered my question earlier, which was based on chapter 10, verse 15, so I thank you for that. The turn of events was ordered by God to fulfill prophecy. I gather that prophecy was that judgment was coming.
Yes.
And so we see the hand of judgment as God lifting his blessing and letting sin run its course in society or whatever. Just to comment on Dan's prayer for deliverer, I think Asa, for whatever else he might have done, has a pretty good spirit of what the kind of deliverer we need in our land.
Yes.
And it's in chapter 14, I'll just read it, verse 11. And Asa cried out to the Lord. This is when the million army from Ethiopia is coming down.
Yeah.
Lord, is it nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power? Help us, O Lord, our God, for we rest on you. And in your name we will go against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Do not let man prevail. And so the Lord struck the Ethiopians. The Lord struck them. Mm-hmm. I gather that this, by his army, not the army of Asa,
right,
but the Lord's army, I gather that must have been an angelic intervention that came in and did a mighty work. Would it not be legitimate? I've been praying this way, but maybe you can confirm it or think it's not appropriate to pray that God would release angelic warfare in the principalities, and even on the battlefield, coming all the way down to earth. I'd like some insight on that, if that's a legitimate way to pray.
Right. Well, I think that the, going back to Abraham Lincoln, the greatness of Lincoln, and this is going back to what we're going to learn about civil society with our circles, our triangles, etc. You remember we said a few weeks ago that we are not a democracy in the pure sense of the word. The demos is simply the people. And a democracy can be extremely cruel because you've only got to get 51% and you can do what you like with the other 49%. And so if 51% of you are Hindus, you can persecute the 49% who are Muslims because you are a democracy. But in the Western tradition, democracy has always functioned through a republic. And a republic are people we trust, we elect, because of their moral, ethical vision. And that's what happened with Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln was not a popular man. But you see, we don't vote in people to govern through focus groups. Okay, we vote them in because we think they have some moral fiber and that they will do the right thing despite their popularity. That is leadership. That is leadership. And that is why what we have running through the kings, and I'll give you a chart next week, we have an equal number of prophets. And the prophets are those irritating people who keep agitating the kings to say, you do what is right. You do what is right. And I think that I know I'm kind of circumventing or rather, you know, perambulating around your question, Glenn. But I think that that was also where the prophetic word comes in and the prophetic community comes in. And we have legitimacy, you see, when there's justice in our midst. You see, we can speak about justice. When this is functioning, you see, in our midst, then we have the moral authority to speak it out into the nation. And so where we're going on all that is that we need to pray that God would raise up people of righteousness who simply won't stand because they're popular. And of course, Lincoln is what assassinated, is it 4 days into his second presidency? 4 days, whatever, because they hated him. But if he had not stood, God would have judged this nation. He could not allow that, you know. And so, you know, again, you know, these are heavy things. But we are central. We are central with modeling what a community of justice is. We are central with our prayers, our commitment to justice. We are central for God getting this thing into the earth. And again, what Ty was talking about this morning, that's not peripheral to all this. That's why all this exists. Why are we wading through all this material on Chronicles? Because this is God's scheme to heal the wound of the world. This is the scheme to rid society of street children and prostitution and totalitarian rulers. You see, he has a configuration, okay? It's under the model of a temple here, but with us, we are the temple. We are that temple. We are that people. We are that prophetic community. And so where we will be going a little bit further on with our circles, and some of you have asked this question, if this is the circle, okay, if this is the circle of the church, okay, and this is the circle of the states, how do we leaven and seed this? Okay, that's a big question, big question. And we'll come to that. That's why we have this material as well. And we'll see how they did it well and how they did it badly as we go on. Yes, question. Yeah, carry on. Jeff will get to you. We can hear.
Sins just coincidental that they're together, or are they related to each other?
That's a great question.
It doesn't seem that they would be.
That's a great question. The question is that Solomon, sexual perversion and not caring for the poor, heavy taxation, and Sodom, sexual perversion, not caring for the poor, heavy taxation, America, let's say England, okay, because we're much worse, and they are extremely, extremely, you remember it says in Ephesians, do you remember what it says covetousness is idolatry. Now idolatry is when we reconfigure God to legitimize our desires. That's why the most pervasive religions in the world are fertility cults, where you have cult prostitutes. Is very convenient, because now you don't have to, you know, hide your prostitution. You can do it in church. Okay, that sounds terrible, but that's what it is. And fertility religions is that we have sexual interaction that stirs up the gods to have sexual interaction, and their fruitfulness brings rain or crops and whatever. It's a convenient system, isn't it, to legitimize fornication and every kind of perversion. But you see, idolatry is simply reconfiguring God to legitimize what I want. Now it says covetousness is idolatry, which is very, very interesting, because of course when we're coveting, we're not caring for the poor. But where I'm going on all that, you see, is where does gratification stop? You see, now this is a very interesting thing. I just finished Jonathan Edwards on Friday, okay? I made it through Jonathan Edwards on Friday. It's a great, great story. Now, how many of you have read The Life of David Brainerd? David Brainerd. Don't be ashamed if you haven't. Oh, this is awful, this is terrible, this is a disaster, okay. I have now got to buy 200 books on the life of David Brainerd. David Brainerd died, I think he was 27, he was the brightest student at Yale, and he went and lived among the the Native American peoples, and got sick and died in the home of Jonathan Edwards. Edwards was certainly the greatest American theologian ever. Stopped all his work. He was also a pastor. And you may or may not know this, but the first, we talk about the Great Awakening, the first outbreak of the Great Awakening happened in Edwards Church in 1734, ever before there was an outbreak anywhere else in England or Scotland, or it was in Edwards Church in Northampton, in New England. That's where it broke out. Now, David Brainerd died in his house. Edwards stopped all his work, and he wrote the life of David Brainerd, this young man who died at 27 years old. Just the most I can remember. I can hardly talk about David Brainerd without beginning to choke up a little bit. You've got to read this book. Now, before, this is an astonishing thing. I am answering your question, okay? He writes the life of David Brainerd around 1740, I believe, 1740. The most popular book in America before the Revolution, the most widely read book in America before the Revolution was what? The life of David Brainerd, which was all about self-sacrifice. It was all about laying down your life. It was all about giving yourself away. It was all these great virtues. That was the most read book in North America before the Revolution. After the Revolution, the most read book was the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, The Self-Made Man. The Self-Made Man. And we went, and the Revolution had nothing to do with it. Don't worry, I'm not saying you should not have rebelled, okay? There were other sociological factors, but you cannot imagine a greater switch. Everybody is reading about this 27-year-old who throws away his life for Christ and for the gospel and to bring love and justice to these people. Most popular book. And then after the Revolution, now Benjamin Franklin, and I did wade through 700 pages on Benjamin Franklin as well, is a very, very interesting man. He was a friend of George Whitefield, a leader of the Great Awakening. He was not a born-again man. He was the great self-made man. Okay, and Franklin is a great character. But what a switch, from Brainerd to Franklin. You could not have a greater switch than this. And so what happened, and this is the story of the West, you see, once you begin on that pathway, we're not giving ourselves away now, you see. We're now, you know, we want our full potential to be realized, you know, and all our bookstores are full of that, you see. That leads to a path of selfishness, self-gratification. Where does self-gratification end? And your question is, with which I close, okay, what is the link between sexual perversion or gratification and not caring for the poor? Well, they're always linked in every society because they are both self-gratification. And you see, when we start along that path, you see, why do we have this? I'll say it one last time. The African church are furious at the church in the West. They say we have starving children, and you are arguing about your sexual appetites. We can't feed our kids. We don't have aspirin. And you are spending all your time arguing about whether you can ordain a homosexual. And they're furious with that. And so they should be. But you see, once you start down that path of gratification, where does it end? And believe me, it will not, and homosexuality linked to not caring for the poor. Now, this is not, I could say about many other things other than sexual perversion. And of course, look at divorce, you know, look at serial marriage. Do you see what I mean? Look at all the
that heterosexuals are into, but it's gratification. Or whether that's materialism, you see, it's gratification again. And gratification means that we're turned in. Luther's definition of sin was turning in on yourself. And so we move from David Brainerd to Benjamin Franklin. Don't think I don't admire Benjamin Franklin. He is the most colorful and interesting man. But now he is the self-made man, okay? Not the man who gives his life away. Gives his life away.